I'm Joanna Shanks.
I'm Emma Taylor.
And this is Murder, She Spoke.
All right, Joanna, do you have any true crime chat for me this week?
I don't really have much in the way of true crime chat, but there is something that you might be interested in and also that our listeners might be interested in.
Okay.
So I've mentioned before that I'm a big fan of a podcast called Let's Not Meet. So it's based on a subreddit thread. And it's basically people that have had really weird encounters, creepy, you know, sometimes paranormal, though not that often, thankfully, because I'm not really into that so much. But yeah, just people that have had really sort of close encounters, been followed, you know, just real kind of skin crawly stuff. I like to listen to it before I go to bed at night because I'm weird and I'm not really easily scared. Yeah, and again, that was a tip that you gave me, reading it last thing before you go to sleep or listen to the podcast before you go to sleep. So that is kind of like my little routine. I'm a patron of the podcast, but what I find is that I just, it's not enough. It's just not enough. So I've listened to all the regular episodes and all my Patreon episodes as well. So I was looking for a similar podcast, something along the same kind of lines, because I thought, well, I really enjoy the true crime stuff, but I just kind of want to veer in a slightly different direction. And I really like the sort of what are supposed to be true, you know, accounts of, you know, situations that people have found themselves in. So I was having a little Google, and a lot of it, to be honest, is paranormal, which, as I say, I'm just not really into. However, I did find a podcast. Again, I'm a little bit gutted that there's not that many episodes. I think that it might be coming out again, hopefully in a few months. But it's a podcast called Radio Rental. Have you heard of it?
No, I haven't. No.
Okay, so I'm absolutely loving it. I love the format of it. Yeah, I just loving it. I'm going to be sad when I finish these last few episodes. But it's, do you know Rainn Wilson?
Yes.
Yeah, so Rainn Wilson, for anyone who doesn't know, plays Dwight Schrute in the American series of The Office. I really liked his character in The Office. I liked the way he played it. And he basically kind of hosts it. It's written by Payne Lindsay, who also does Up and Vanished.
Yep.
But it's sort of hosted by Rainn Wilson as his character, Terry Carnation.
And Up and Vanished is really good as well, if anyone's interested.
I haven't actually listened to that, but I am going to be going on to that next because I'm enjoying this so much. But yeah, so Rainn Wilson basically plays this video store owner called Terry Carnation, and it's like a sort of little skit that he does on every episode, and it's just kind of silly but laugh out loud funny. And then he basically claims to sort of play these VHS tapes, and it's then what I really like about this one is the fact that it's the person who has encountered it telling you about their encounter, so it's not told by the host. It's in the person's own words, which I really enjoy. I find that just that bit more authentic.
So is it meant to be like when you call up, so say Fourth One are saying, call us up if you've got a funny story about Christmas or something. And
yeah,
it's like people are calling up saying, oh yeah, this one time me and my family did. Is it that kind of thing?
Right, yes. Okay. I'm just really enjoying it. So there's been a couple of releases of it. The last was the last lot ended in November last year, so I'm hoping that in the next few months it'll come out again. But yeah, really enjoying it. So I'm going to go into Up and Vanished after this, which I know is a true crime podcast. But given the fact that I'm enjoying this so much, I assume that I'll also like Up and Vanished.
And it was called
Radio Rental.
Radio Rental. Okay, cool. I'll check it out. Sounds good.
What about you?
Not a huge amount. I've been watching, I think I sent it to you guys. It was a new documentary. Let me find it. Just to get it right, to tell the guy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so not a huge amount. I sent something over to you and some of our podcasting friends that was on Channel 4. It's a new TV show. It's a series. I wasn't sure if it was like a limited series, but it does seem to be a full series. It's called Undercover Police Hunting Pedophiles, which obviously pretty dark stuff.
Right up my street.
Really interesting. Yeah, really interesting though. Like, actually, the police pretending to be children, and some of the ways that they hunt them, and some of the lengths that they go to get these people. And do you know what was really hard? There was a guy that got caught, and he claimed he'd never done anything about it, and he was struggling with the feelings within himself, and he just wanted to talk to other people that were feeling the same way that he did, and that he knew it was disgusting and that he needed help. And I almost felt sorry for him for a split second, and then I was like, nah, because they were like, and then we found on his laptop 20 category A, you know, pictures, mm-hmm. and horrific. So it's like, you didn't feel that bad though, did you? You can't have felt that awful about it. Mm-hmm. And it just reminded me of a really interesting theory that has been put forward in certain countries and by pro-pedophile groups, which just even the thought of it sends ice through my veins. Yeah, that it's just purely from a scientific point of view is interesting that they try and claim that it is akin to homosexuality or any other sexuality that people would claim is differing from the
norm.
Quote unquote norm. Yeah.
Oh my God.
They're claiming that because they're born that way and they cannot help it,
no.
it's built into them that it's just another form of sexuality no. that the world just doesn't understand yet.
Oh my
Which
God.
Is insane. Yeah, I mean, it's insane, but it's the crazy thing is they're using the likes of homosexuality, which they're claiming, oh, well, people say that's not for recreation and it doesn't have any biological reason. And that's a, you know, yeah, it's insane. But
how insulting.
I know. But then again, I also watched a documentary once on zoophiles, who are people that have sexual attraction to animals, and they try and have the same argument. So I think we can file all of that under things we wish we had never heard and are not going to talk about ever again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm actually, it does sound kind of morbid, but I am genuinely interested to watch that program because I could, and I know this would probably be hard for a lot of people to get their head around, I could probably see myself working in like child sex crimes and exploitation. That's probably an area that I think I could work in. Maybe I'm being incredibly naive in saying that, but it's something that I think is hugely important, needs a lot of focus, and
I think as long as you safeguard yourself and you know the risks going in and you know that there's a chance that it could affect you, then it's an admirable thing to do, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely.
I won't be doing that.
I'm gonna watch that.
Good for you.
I might watch it and then be like, actually, I'm just gonna retract that statement.
Actually, I'm going to work as a fairy at children's parties instead.
I think I've become really good at compartmentalizing.
Yeah, I don't know if I would be. Honestly, I've got so much respect for people that are able to work in that environment and see the horrors that they see and still go home and live their lives and shut their minds off to it. But I just feel that I would struggle with that. And I think that that's a limitation that I maybe need to acknowledge and accept.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So what is the case you've got for me this week?
So I have decided to go for a slightly older case. It is fairly well known, so you may know of this person. And it's the case of Archibald Hall. So Archibald Hall, a.k.a. the Monster Butler.
Ooh.
Yeah. Have you heard of him?
I don't think so.
Okay. So I know that some of our listeners do like the slightly older cases. So Archibald Thompson Hall was born in Glasgow in 1924. He lived in what he described as a poor working class district in the west section of the city, with his parents, Archibald Senior, and his mother, who's called Marion. He was really good in school, pretty well behaved as a child and an early teen, nothing really of note to talk about in his childhood. He was very close to his mother the whole way through his and her lives. And part of the research for this case, I actually read his book that he wrote about his life, which will give it away a bit. The Wicked Mr. Hall, The Memoirs of the Butler Who Loved to Kill. So that is his book that I read. I recommend if people want to read more on him that they pick up. You can get it on Amazon and on Kindle. So he talks a little bit about his childhood, but like I said, there's actually nothing really of note, fairly bog standard Glaswegian upbringing. And then he met a neighbour of theirs. So the woman that lived across the street from them ran a shop. Her name is Anne Phillips, and he started helping her out in her shop when he was 15 years old. He started a sexual relationship with her when he was 16, and she made quite a good amount of money from running her shop, but she was pretty rubbish as a shopkeeper. He said that she didn't really do her accounts the way that she should unless she really had to. And one time he was over there and he saw her have a hidden compartment. So she'd lifted up part of the till and there was some hidden money, and he started stealing from her. Interestingly, he didn't need to start stealing from her because she was a bit of a sugar mama to him. She would take him out for fancy meals and she would buy him things. She bought him a really beautiful, I think it was like a tailored jacket that she got him. And he went home and was showing it off to his mum and his dad, and his dad lost the plot and said, "You're not taking things from this woman across the road. We don't know." He didn't know that they were in a relationship, and he just thought it was a bit sus because this woman was, she was super old. She was apparently a widow in her early 30s. And I was like, wow, imagine being that old. So the dad was really unhappy and kicked off, and Archibald actually took a knife to him and kind of lost the plot and basically said, "You won't be saying anything about that again." And yeah, his dad didn't challenge him again after that on anything. So Anne had been taking him out for nice meals, like I said, showed him a bit of the high life that he wasn't really used to, but obviously quite liked. So he started stealing from her, and he used the money to go to restaurants by himself. He started socializing in a higher class scene than he would have had available to him naturally through his background. When he left school, he was kind of loath to get a job because he didn't want to work for less than what he was stealing. He liked the lifestyle that he'd become accustomed to. So what he started to do was, during the daytime, he started to case out houses. And this was around about 1940. It was in the middle of World War II and burglar alarms were completely unheard of. He would then go back and burgle the properties at night and steal cash and small items of jewellery. And he would usually enter through something that we wouldn't have nowadays, an unlocked door or an unlocked window. Around about this time, around about 1940, Archie's father was conscripted into the army to join the war effort. So he hadn't been called up the first time for World War I, but he was called up for World War II. And they moved him to a camp in Yorkshire. So Archibald's mum, Marion, she sold the house and the family home, all its contents, and they followed his father to Catterick Army Camp in Yorkshire. While he was at this camp, Archibald decided not to give up his newfound fun, and he continued to steal, this time from military men. He befriended the officers' batmen. I didn't know these existed. They were a type of manservant. So they looked after the officers. Each senior officer would have a batman for him. And he befriended them, would do like little jobs for them and just basically asked them how they shined the shoes and all this kind of stuff. But he also then found out about the timetables of these officers. So when the officers were away, he would go into their barracks and steal the cash and the jewellery from them. So he's starting off pretty strong. It gets fairly frustrating when you're reading the book. He's completely unstoppable. It's essentially an addiction for him, stealing.
Kleptomaniac.
Yeah. In 1941, Archie's father was dismissed from the army, which was ostensibly due to him being deemed too old for service. He does say in the book that when he befriended some of the officers, they gave him trinkets and memorabilia. So included in that was Nazi memorabilia. And apparently he had things hung up on the wall in their accommodation, and officers came around and confiscated it all. And then later on in life, he at one point tried to get into the Navy and was unsuccessful, and he believes that it might be to do with that, that they thought he was subversive. But it doesn't really sound from his, it just sounds like he was just a boy that was interested in the war efforts. And at the time, having Nazi memorabilia was just like the soldiers just gave him little bits and pieces of stuff and he just kept it. I don't know either way, but it is a bit odd. Either way, his dad, shortly after they came to find this stuff, his dad was dismissed from the army. So read into that what you will. The family ended up back in Glasgow. And his dad had worked in the post office. He went back to work in the post office. Archibald was meant to get a job. So what he decided to do was become an unpaid voluntary collector for the Red Cross. So that was like going around with a tin to people's houses and asking them for money. And he quite enjoyed the fact that that made him look very noble and like he was doing something really good with his life. However, in reality, what he was doing was he was giving the coin donations over to the Red Cross, but any paper notes that came, he would just fish them out and pocket them. And then he would target wealthier and wealthier areas because they were more likely to give notes. So he felt that it was a fair split because he was doing the legwork for free. So he just pocketed the cash. Over the next few years, he devised numerous scams and plots to let him rob and burgle basically at will. One of them was a scam that he devised where he would dress up in silk gloves, a top hat, look very kind of wealthy, and he would go to estate agents and say that his father and his family were coming back from India and they needed to rent a home. But they were very wealthy, so they really wanted something quite amazing, something top shelf, show me the best properties that you've got kind of thing. He would then go with them, view the property. He would take a note of the doors, the locks, and actually back in the day, if he saw the key, so you know how you go and get a key cut nowadays. Mm-hmm. Apparently back in the day, there was numbers written on the side of them. So if he saw those, he would go and get a key cut so that if he didn't have to break in, he would just open the door, and he would speak to them, say, okay, well, I want to come back and do another viewing. What about such and such a day? And any day that they would say, oh no, we can't do that day because we're actually doing a viewing at another place, he would then go back and burgle the home then.
Okay. So the keys were like numbered, as in you could just go to the key cutter and say, I need a key 18.
A 126 or something. Yeah. And they would cut it and it would fit that door.
Right.
Yeah. So that's what he did. He turned it into a job. He would get on the train. So he lived in Glasgow at the time, but he would do it in Glasgow and he would do it in Edinburgh. He would commute through to Edinburgh and spend his days doing that. And he viewed it as a profession of sorts. So he knew that some of the things that he was stealing, like the jewellery, were going to be noticed and he couldn't just sell them in Edinburgh or Glasgow. So then he would take the train down to London and sell them as well. When he spent his weekends in London, he immersed himself in this life of luxury, but he also explored his sexuality. He'd known from a fairly young age that he was bisexual. And if you read his book, honestly, He just sleeps with everyone.
Okay.
He has had a very free and happy life, and he slept with people to gain entrance to their homes. He slept with them so that he could steal from them. He slept with them to get them to do stuff for him. He slept with people because he felt sorry for them, for comfort, because he was bored. Honestly, if you name it, he's done it. So when he was in London for these weekends, he would enter this elite gay socialite scene. And he went to parties with them, secretive parties. There was high flyers, people that were married to women who were homosexual. There was people just doing lots of illicit things. There was orgies. It was quite amazing for someone that had come from his background. Mm-hmm. So he spent his time there.
Eyes wide shut.
Yeah, exactly. So he learned their ways. He learned to fit in with the elite as well. So while he was there, he wasn't only getting involved in the sexual side of things. He was seeing how they dressed and where they went and what wines they would serve with what food and all that kind of stuff. And he gave himself a new name. He called himself Ray Fontaine. So this is what he was doing while he was down in London, but he was also down there to sell the jewels and get the cash. It's pretty smart, to be honest. He knew that he couldn't chance being found out in Scotland. So when he was back in Glasgow, he realised that he'd used this estate agent scam pretty much as to its extent before the police were going to catch on, because there's only so many times that he could do it without someone twigging. So he thought, right, I need a new thing. What's my new thing? So he set up a secondhand and antique store in Ibrox in Glasgow. Mm-hmm. He bought and sold bric-a-brac, antiques, secondhand goods, all that kind of thing. He also was known for buying questionable items that young thieves had come by, kind of under the counter. By the time he was 21 years old, the business was flourishing and he was doing really, really well. He had ostensibly a normal wealthy businessman's life. There was a young doctor, a young male doctor, came to visit the shop one day to sell some bits and pieces to him. He became friends with him and then they became lovers. And he was aware that his business wasn't always above board. So what he started to do was he would start telling him about recently bereaved families, people who are wealthy. Hall would go and visit them and essentially would say, oh, you don't need all this pain and all these sad memories. I know you just want to clear the whole place out. Tell you what I'll do. I'll offer you X amount. I'll take it. I'll go through it. I'll get rid of the trash and stuff like that. And you don't need to worry about it. And he would give them a really low price for all the bits and pieces. And then he'd sell them a great profit in a shop. So he was always looking for new ways to defraud people and make money through his ill gains. So his business was booming, but despite this, Archie felt trapped in a normal job and he wasn't getting the thrill. He wasn't getting just the enjoyment out of living the lifestyle that he wanted to live. So he started stealing from clients that came to the shop. He had clients that would come fairly frequently, get rid of things that they didn't want, old jewellery and things like that. And there was a well-known wealthy couple who came in who they told him that they were having a lavish party to celebrate their silver anniversary. And most people would go, oh, that's so lovely, you know, hope you have a nice time. He thought silver anniversary means silver gifts. And these people are rich, their friends are rich, they're going to get real silver. So while the party went on in central Glasgow, he broke into their home and stole their anniversary gifts.
Oh my God.
I know. He's shameless. And if you read the book, he's not remorseful in any way. He's completely proud of it. He actually talks through how he comes up with these plans and yeah, he's totally proud of it. It is just shameless. It's unbelievable. So these crimes caught up with him in 1945. He had stolen jewels from a house in Perth. This is something I will say about him. He's not afraid to travel around the country to try and get away with stuff. He's all over the UK. He's here, there, zipping all over the shop. He's, you know, he hears a rumor about someone who's rich and such, and they sleep really heavily. He goes and robs them, then he'll go to London and sell it. Then he's off to Brighton. Then he's up. I mean, it's, you can barely keep up with the man. I don't know how he's not exhausted. Mm-hmm. So he stole these jewels from a house in Perth. He traveled to London to sell them, and he was sitting in a high-end jeweler's in London, and he noticed that the assistants he was trying to sell them to were a bit funny with him. And then they both disappeared into the manager's office. And then a policeman arrived shortly thereafter. And he was arrested. Yeah. So I think it was jade that he'd stolen from this lady. And a lot of, it was quite rare in the country at the time. And I think the jewellery was fairly well known and had been disseminated to the different police forces. So they knew that if someone was going to sell this very unique jade, it would be the person that stole it most likely. So he was being taken back to Scotland to be tried for stealing these jewels. He was in police custody, and then at Carlisle train station, just after it, he asked the policeman if he could go to the toilet, and they said yes. He was left unsupervised for a matter of minutes, and he leapt from the train.
Wow.
And yeah. So he, in motion, so this was after he'd left the train station, he leapt from the train. He made his way to Glasgow, partly by foot, partly by hitching a ride as well, by various people. But then when he got to Glasgow, he made contact with family and friends, and he was captured by police again. As a result of aiding him, his mother was sentenced to 28 days in prison. And actually, this is another thing that I found quite amazing. He really hates the justice system, generally speaking. And he's very angry that they sent his mum to prison because she was just doing her motherly duty.
What?
I know. It's, yeah, he's got some questionable views on things. So he was sent to Barlinnie. He served 2/3 of his sentence. I don't know exactly how long it was for. I think it was a couple of years. And on his release, he travelled back to London, where he started using the name Ray Fontaine all the time. And he re-entered the London gay scene. He once again spent his time burglarising and robbing as he pleased. And he used the funds to fund a flat in central London. He led this life for just under a year. And then he was once again arrested and convicted of burglary and sent to HMP Wandsworth for 2 years. While he was at Wandsworth, he met who was to be a lifelong friend and a fairly important figure in his life, a man called John Wooten. Hall describes his time in prison as harsh, but interestingly, I just thought this was an odd quote. This is what he said, quote, "The experience of prison hardens a man, providing justification for the crimes he is going to commit," unquote. So not prison hardens a man, you learn your lesson, and then you come back out and you think, thank God I'm never going back in then. Mm-hmm. No, he says it provides justification to just go and do it again because you're hardened to it. It's just an interesting take that I had never, I would never go there with my brain. That's just not the logical route it would take. So I thought that was an interesting thing. In 1949, Hall was released from prison. He went into business with his new pal, John Wooten, who now went by Johnny Collins and had refashioned himself as a London gangster. He had like a scar on his face and there was various stories about him. So they decided that they were going to be kind of a smash and grab gang robbing jewellery stores. And they would do things like literally drive into the window of a jeweller's and grab the stuff and run away. And they had various places around London that they knew they could go and hide. So pub landlords who would maybe have an upstairs that they lived in, they would just go in, go up the stairs, and that was then vanished and they would get a cut. People, so they had these different hidey holes around about London and they were notorious. Unsurprisingly, they were both caught again and sent back to prison. Can you see a common theme occurring here? Yeah. So they're very
sticky
good
bandits.
Yeah, I mean, they're very good at burglary, but they are terrible at not getting caught. Mm. So, yeah, back in prison. During Hall's next stint in prison, he spent much of his time studying antiquities, art, and the profession of butlering. He found a book on how to be a butler and he found it really, really interesting. So he was interested in going into service when he left prison. And someone like yourself or myself might think that's good. He wants an honest profession. But of course, he doesn't want an honest profession. Yep. He wants to get closer to people who are rich enough for him to steal
easy
from.
Easy access.
Exactly.
That's all it is to him.
Over the next decade, Hall and Wootton worked as butlers and gameskeepers for the nobility, stealing and being fired whenever their criminal pasts were discovered. No one was safe. They stole from colleagues, strangers, acquaintances, lovers. Anyone was a mark, essentially. Hall describes himself as a career criminal, a professional thief, and in his book, he openly brags about how good he was. It's honestly amazing to read the different ways that he comes up with stealing from... It's very clever. I mean, he tailors it to every individual situation. He's happy to play the long game. He's happy to become a lover of someone if that helps him get closer. And he's actually, there's a point in the book where he says that he saw someone's diamonds and when he touched them, he became sexually aroused. Like, it's bizarre. Like, he's actually driven solely by money and stealing from people. It's insane. Another thing that he's totally obsessed with is blending in to the elite. He talks about all the famous people he's met, all the famous liaisons he's had with people who were later knighted or, you know, honoured in some way. He likes to name drop quite a lot. So this is something for him that's clearly important. He was in and out of prison over and over again until 1975. He even managed to escape prison during this time and was on the lam for 3 years. He escaped with three other prisoners and they did a kind of Shawshank Redemption-esque plot. They escaped through the walls, basically.
Okay.
And yeah, he was on the run and managed to stay mostly hidden in that time. Once again, by stealing from people, by making up fake names, by just generally being a bit of a terrible human being. So that period of time is just a carousel of victims, betrayals, and Hall generally using and abusing everyone around him.
Yep.
He fell deeply in love with a fellow man in prison before he was released in 1975. When he left prison, he then fell in love with a woman and married her. He was still deeply in love with the man, Dave Bernard, who was still in prison. He was to be released after Archie was. So he was married to a woman who also says he was deeply in love with, but not as in love with as he was the man. Okay. And he'd never apparently loved anyone until he'd met either of them, which is interesting. And he was still sleeping with various other people at the time. So he's in this kind of crazy love triangle that his wife doesn't know about. And then another criminal counterpart told him, oh, I was stealing something from a house. I found this clock. And when I opened it up, there were these secret government papers inside. I don't know if you want to do something with them. I don't know what to do with them and I don't want to get in trouble. So do you want them? And he says, yes, this is great. His first thing to do was that he tried to barter with the government to have his lover released from jail.
Okay.
This did not work. He then decided to try and sell the papers to the Russian embassy.
Okay.
This also did not work. It didn't pan out for him. And he was arrested for various different things, burglary, having the cabinet papers in the first place, and also the possibility of treason, which could be life in prison. Mm-hmm. His wife found out about the lover. The UK government obviously found out about the attempted treason. And he claims, I don't have anything else to back this up. He claims that the reason he was only sentenced to 2 years was because he threatened to disclose his sexual liaisons with men of high standing in society.
Okay.
So he threatened to disclose the sex parties that he'd been to, talk about all these things that had happened, and that's why he was only sentenced to 2 years.
That's a very low sentence for what he's done.
It's a very low sentence.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, he's sentenced to 2 years in prison, and he's back in prison, and Dave Bernard is released from prison and very sadly dies horrifically in a car accident with the car that Archie had bought for him.
Oh.
His wife had come to prison and he essentially said to her, "I can't love you the way that I want you to be loved, and you deserve more, so divorce me." So she divorces him. Then Dave Bernard dies horrifically. And Hall says that this was kind of a turning point in his life. He's lost the two loves of his life. And I think he feels like he's lost everything. He's not got anything to look forward to. He's not got anything to hope for. And this definitely was a downward spiral from there on out. He was really looking forward to spending time with Dave Bernard. He had all these ideas about where they would go. And to be honest, it's not your classic love story. It's very much like, we'll steal a bunch of money off a bunch of people and run off into the sunset. But mm-hmm. I'm guessing for him, that is his version of a love story. So it is what it is. So in 1975, Hall is out of prison. His lover's died and he doesn't really know quite what to do with himself. He sees an advertisement for a butler role for a lady, Margaret Hudson, in Dumfriesshire, in Scotland. He applies for the role and finds himself at Kirkleton House, which is a stately home with Margaret at the helm. Another old lover from prison named David Wright contacted Hall and convinced him to get a job on the staff. Wright is a thief too, but he's a petty one in comparison to Hall. So Hall's been working this job, obviously casing the house and the riches within it for months and months, and he's playing the long game. It claims to have been sleeping with Lady Margaret Hudson as well, and has ingratiated himself with her in more ways than one, by the sounds of it. So he's casing this. This is his long game. He knows what he's going to do. And then David Wright comes along, he gets him a job there, and he is infuriated that he finds a diamond ring stolen from Lady Margaret, hidden in a sock in David's drawer. He goes mental at him for his betrayal. There was also another thing. When they were in prison together, Hall had given a tip-off to David Wright, basically had told him how to burgle somewhere, and David Wright went and burgled it, and he was expecting him to give him a cut of the money when he got out of prison, and he never did. So he was just really angry at him generally about his betrayal, about his greed, and the fact that he had nearly screwed up this situation for him. So they have a big fight and they both go to bed. Hall thinks, it'll all blow over in the morning. We'll get up, we'll talk it over. They were still lovers as well. Maybe we'll kiss and make up. What actually happened was he went to sleep and was awoken by the sound of a gunshot. David Wright was really drunk and he was standing at the end of Hall's bed and he tried to shoot him in the head and missed. He was screeching, saying, we're not doing this. We're just going to rob the place tonight. We'll burn it down. We'll do whatever we need to do. Like, this is what's happening. So Hall manages to calm him down. He's like, right, we'll just go to bed. Forget about it. You're drunk. It doesn't matter. We'll get up tomorrow and we'll deal with it then. But he's not forgotten that he just tried to kill him. The next morning, David Wright is beside himself. He's so sorry. He can't believe what happened. He was drunk. He didn't mean it, etc., etc. So Hall decides to say to David, and actually the friend from years before, the one, John Wooten, who changed his name to Johnny Collins. So John Wooten had come to visit him. At this point, Lady Margaret does not know that any of these people are criminals, by the way. She has no idea that there's three criminals on her estate at that point in time. So he says, look, let's just get on with it. Why don't we go shooting rabbits? We'll put it behind us. We'll go and have a nice day and we'll shoot some rabbits. You can probably see where this is going. They go shooting rabbits and he turns on David and shoots him in the head after screaming at him about his betrayal. He then tried to dig the frozen ground for a shallow grave and he couldn't because it was too hard. So he dragged David's body to a small stream, stripped him naked so that there was no identifying clothing or anything, and placed heavy boulders on him to weigh down the body. Over the following days, he returned every day. He kept moving around plants, like planting things, putting debris, putting foliage and flowers and everything around this body and the area so that he couldn't see the body anymore, although it was in a very remote area that no one really would have been able to find him anyway unless they were looking for him. That was Archibald Hall's first kill. It would not be his last, unfortunately. Shortly after the murder, it's unclear who, but someone called Lady Margaret and told her about Hall's criminal past, and she fired him. It probably didn't help that his criminal past was stealing from rich people, to be fair. So that was his first murder. Hall's next victims came in the form of 82-year-old Walter Scott Elliott, who was a wealthy Labour MP, and his wife Dorothy, who was 62. He met them in the summer of 1977 in London, and he was soon employed by them to be their butler. Right from the start, Hall decided that they were going to die. He assumed control of their finances and their affairs. He was planning on draining their bank account and then fleeing abroad. This didn't stop him from attempting to rob other people in the meantime. So he was now in his 50s and he wasn't quite as limber as he was when he was younger and climbing through windows and the like. So he made the acquaintance of a man called Michael Kittle, who was a small-time career criminal, and he wanted to use him a bit like a protege. So he basically said to him, right, I'm going away with the Scott Elliots to their summer home in Italy for a while in the summer, as you do, you know, summer home in Italy, classic. And he said, well, we're away, I want you to rob the house. So he got Michael Kittle round one evening while Mrs. Scott Elliott was away at a friend's and her husband was asleep. He was known to take sleeping tablets. So he said, he'll be out for the count, come around and I'll show you around the house. I'll show you what you need to steal. So he's showing him around the place, pointing out the items that he wanted stolen. And Dorothy, Mrs. Scott Elliott, had come home early and basically said, who the hell is this man and what is he doing in my house? Kittle jumped and he totally freaked out. He basically smothered her. He totally overreacted. He put his hand over her face and he smothered her to death and she dropped dead very quickly. It's unknown if she had underlying health conditions that caused it because from the sound of it, it was very quick. Or maybe she had a heart attack from the fright or something along those lines. Either way, she surprised them, Kittle jumped on her, and she died very, very quickly. Horrified, Hall sprang into action. This was not part of his plan. This was not the way that things were meant to go, and he was just gobsmacked. So he quickly decided that they needed to do something about this and kind of speed up the plan. Apparently, Walter had actually woken up at the commotion, and he went through and just said, oh, no, don't worry about it, it's nothing. Your wife came back and she's not feeling great, so she's in bed or something along those lines. So what he did was he woke up the next morning, told Walter that his wife had gone to visit friends. There was a female accomplice called Mary Coggles that they knew, also from the criminal underworld, and he essentially stuck a wig on her so that she looked like Dorothy. He accompanied her around all the banks that the couples had accounts in and used her and the signatures that he now knew how to forge, and they withdrew a bunch of money from the couple's bank accounts. He then got his old friend John Wooten, the female accomplice, Mary Coggles, who was also an ex-lover, by the way, or current lover. It's actually quite hard to keep track. And Michael Kittle and Walter. So they're all with him. He puts Dorothy's body in the boot of the car. He has Walter in the car. And Hall slipped a sedative, one of his sleeping pills, into his drink and said, Dorothy's gone to Scotland and she wants you to meet her there. So I've got a chauffeur, we're going up to Scotland. And I don't know exactly how he explained away Mary dressed in the wig, which I can't imagine was the best quality wig in the 1970s. But regardless, they drugged Walter pretty much the whole way north with whiskey and sleeping pills. They stopped in a remote area outside of Crieff and dug a shallow grave in a field, and they just left Dorothy's body there. They continued their journey and stayed a night in Blair Athol, with Walter still being drugged. And then there was Hall, Kittle, and the female associate, Mary Coggles. Hall was aware at this point that they needed to get rid of Walter. They basically tried their true and tested. They drove to the Scottish Highlands. Walter woke up from his drug-addled nap. He said, I need to go to the toilet. And Hall pounced on him while he was urinating and he strangled him. The old man fought back, but then Hall shouted on Kittle to get the spade that he had in the boot from burying Dorothy. And Kittle smashed him on the head with a spade. Once again, they dug a shallow grave and they left him in it. And they started driving home. They went back to London and they actually lived in the house of the Scott Elliots, spending their money and living the high life generally. They were quite concerned about Mary's behaviour. In his words, more or less, Mary was perhaps not the brightest spark and wasn't very good at keeping things hush-hush. So she was bragging openly to friends about this high life that she was living, and she had a mink coat that she'd stolen from Dorothy, and she'd kept this coat. She was wearing it around, and it had Dorothy's initials embroidered on it. It was worth several thousand pounds. There was no way that someone like Mary would normally have been able to afford a coat like that, so she was just raising eyebrows all over the place. So Kittle and Hall decided that Mary was a bit of a liability and definitely not worth going to jail over. One evening in the London home of the Scott Elliots, they'd all been drinking, and Hall once again said to Mary, you cannot keep that coat. It's not your coat. It's worth thousands of pounds and it's linked to the dead woman that thankfully nobody knows is dead yet, but if they find out, it's going to lead directly back to you. She was drunk and she once again outright refused. She said it was her coat, she was keeping it, and there was nothing they could do about it. Unfortunately, that was not the case. Hall grabbed a fire poker and Kittle held her arms. Hall smashed the poker into her head, but unfortunately she still had the wig on and it kind of cushioned the blow, so she wasn't dead. He then tied a plastic bag around her neck, and the two of them sat and watched her suffocate, and they sipped brandy as they did so. They then dressed her body in men's clothes. They drove her body to Dumfriesshire and threw her over a hedge and into a stream. They then returned to the Scott Elliot residence in London and sold everything that they could. They emptied the home of anything of worth and lived the high life, went out to West End shows, ate the best food, drank the best wine, and enjoyed themselves. During this time, Archibald Hall's half-brother Donald was released from prison. He had been in jail for housebreaking and was suspected to be a paedophile by Hall. Hall wanted nothing to do with him. He really hates him from just the tone that he speaks about him. He just utterly despises him. So Donald came looking for him. he was fairly aware that his brother was, you know, quite high up criminal professional, essentially. And I think he wanted in on the action. So he decided to get rid of Donald as well. He had a holiday-let cottage in Newton Arlush, which is in England, the north of England. This is one of the more horrible parts of the story. Donald was trying to show off to Kitto and Hall, and he showed them a way that someone in jail had showed him to restrain someone and tie them up so that they couldn't move. They essentially let him tie himself up, and then they subdued him with chloroform and then drowned him in a bath. In his book, he shows no remorse for this at all, and he describes him as low-life scum. Later on, when they did find the body, they found out that he'd actually been killed by the chloroform. They'd essentially smothered him with the chloroform. And he makes a comment that's really flippant. It's something like, oh, I didn't need to bother holding the body down under the bath washer then. Wish I'd known that at the time. Which just shows how evil and cruel he was as a person. He knew that Donald's fingerprints would be on record because he'd been in jail. So he really wanted to make sure that the body was not found. So they put the body in the boot of the car. Once again, they drove to Scotland. I'm not entirely sure why they keep picking Scotland to dump bodies. I want to clarify to everyone listening to this, please don't come and dump all your bodies in Scotland. We don't want them, and they will be found. So keep them to yourself.
Because there's so many remote areas.
Yeah. But I guess also he was Scottish, and they do say that people tend to commit crimes and dump bodies in places that they're more familiar with. So I don't know if maybe that was something to do with it. Either way, once again, he's decided, I'm going to dump a body in Scotland. So he drove up with Kitto, put the body in the boot of the car, and they headed east. And they drove out past Dunbar and decided to stay the night at North Berwick. The manager at the hotel, the Blenheim Arms, he didn't like the look of them. He just thought they were shifty, he thought they were acting weird, and he just generally didn't like them. So he called the police and got them to come and check them out. So Archibald Hall had asked Kitto to change the license plates on the car because the one that was on the car ended in 999, and he was superstitious and he didn't like that. So Kitto had changed the license plate on the car, but because he was a little bit lazy and also because he wasn't a particularly professional criminal, he didn't change the tax plates to match. So when the police got there, they checked it, and whichever law it broke, they decided to arrest them for it. So they brought them in, and actually one of the police drove the car with the body in the boot to the police station, not knowing that there was a dead body in the boot, which just gives me the heebie-jeebies. While they were in the police station, Hall asked to go to the toilet, and he jumped out the window of the toilet. He ran. He managed to get a local taxi driver to take him to Edinburgh. He convinced him. He said something along the lines of his wife was in the hospital and he needed to get to Edinburgh. Something like that. Either way, he managed to convince this guy to drive him. They got all the way to 20 miles outside of Edinburgh, and there was a roadblock. A police roadblock had been set up. He stopped the car and he was arrested. Finally.
Good.
He was taken to a cell in Edinburgh, and he promptly swallowed two barbiturate capsules, which was his suicide attempt. He kept this kit on him in case he was ever captured. You'll be glad to know that this was unsuccessful. He was promptly swept to Edinburgh Royal Infirmary. He then found out that Kitto had given a full confession, and he knew the gig was up. Having heard that, Hall confessed fully, including to the murder of Dave Wright, which Kitto didn't know about. So he actually went over and above what had already been told to the police. In January of 1978, Archibald Hall accompanied police to the grave of Walter. And then days later, he accompanied them to that of Dave Wright. Kitto had a pretty terrible memory. He couldn't actually remember where the bodies were buried at all. He had no idea. And it doesn't sound like Archibald really knew or remembered where the body of Dorothy had been buried exactly, because it took them days to find her, partly because it was the ground was frozen, but they had cadaver dogs and it still took them days to find her corpse, unfortunately. The body of Mary Coggles had actually been found not long after they dumped her, but it wasn't linked to them initially, and they had just presumed it was a completely unrelated incident. I don't actually think they hadn't even identified her, because there was nothing on her body. So it was only when they were caught and they kind of pulled everything together that they managed to link it all. 5 months later, Archibald Hall was given 2 life sentences for the murders of Dave Wright and Walter Scott Elliot. He was then taken to be tried in England for the murders of his half-brother, Donald, and his accomplice, Mary Coggles. He pled guilty and he was given life again. If you do purchase the book to read, I will make you aware that the last portion of Hall's book is full of complaints and self-pity. It's basically him detailing his struggles in prison and moaning about how difficult his life is. So I'm not going to bore you with any of those details. I don't think they deserve the airtime, quite frankly. He died of a stroke in prison in 2002, aged 78. So that is the story of Archibald Hall, aka the Monster Butler, a Scottish serial killer. Do you have any questions?
That was really good. I actually realised when we got to the bit about the elderly couple, the what are they called?
Scott Elliots.
The Scott Elliots, that I'd heard it before. When you said Ray Fontaine, it rang a bell, and I thought, I think I've heard this story before. And then the Scott Elliots, and then going to Scotland in the car, and I knew it in the boot. I was like, yep, I've definitely heard this story before. I think maybe on another podcast, but I hadn't heard all the earlier background.
To be honest, unless you read his book, you don't get the earlier backgrounds.
Yeah.
So that was why I wanted to read it. And I always find it interesting reading these kind of things in people's own words. The arrogance of the man is just astounding, and how he justifies the things that he's done. And also, he just thinks he's such a Lothario. He thinks he's so clever and he thinks he gets away with everything. And
it's just that typical grandiose mindset, isn't it? That they think they're so clever, they're so much better than everybody else, and they'll never get caught. It's just that, that, like you say, the arrogance, just that grandiose kind of attitude. Yeah, totally get it. That was really...
other criminals, oh, he was good, but he wasn't as good as me.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I saw this man, this handsome man, looking at me across the bar. I could tell what he wanted. And he's unnecessarily vulgar about some of the sexual encounters, and it's just for shock factor. Do you know that way?
That doesn't surprise me, yeah. That was really, really good. I really enjoyed that. I liked the fact, obviously, it was based on a book, and then it was like a really in-depth background and story. So, yeah, that was really, really good.
Cute. I know you like the historic ones.
Definitely, well. Yeah. I did enjoy that. That was quite entertaining.
I've got a picture of him as well. You can let me know if you think he's worth all these people losing their minds over.
I'm going to hit you up with a funny true crime related tidbit. So just a little one this week. So the aptly named Christopher Badman, from Bridgend in South Wales, used a carrier bag on his head as a disguise when he burgled a hotel in nearby Portcawl? I'm not sure how you pronounce that, during its annual Elvis Presley convention. Unfortunately for him, he was captured on CCTV taking the bag off his head and looking towards the camera. He had gone to some trouble to disguise his identity, but once the bag was off, of course his cover was blown, said police, who then traced him. Badman admitted burglary and was ordered to pay £900 in costs and a £100 surcharge.
Oh, you mean he didn't end up getting to sing the jailhouse rock then?
No, afraid not.
Why Why didn't he just dress like Elvis Presley? Would he just look the same as everyone?
Exactly. Yeah, that would have been a really good disguise, given the fact it was an Elvis Presley convention. But yeah, it's ridiculous. There is a picture. Oh, actually, I think it's a video. he bounced off the wall.
So he didn't even cut holes in the bag.
No, so it looks like he's trying to see at the bottom of it, and it also doesn't look like a very expensive hotel. He comes out of a door. He's not wearing the bag. Then
What's he trying to steal from them?
I no idea. No idea.
Is it those biscuits that they put in the rooms because they are quite good?
I don't know, but yeah, it's
travel size shortbread and a shower cap.
Yeah. And a little sachet of hot chocolate. Yeah, it's pathetic. But yeah, so he totally deserved to get caught. So
love it.
No sympathy.
Definitely not.
You've been listening to Murder, She Spoke. If you have enjoyed this episode and you would like to leave us a 5-star rating or review, please head over to your favourite podcast platform of choice. You can also get in touch with us. You can email us info@murdershespoke.net if you want to get in touch and give us a case recommendation. You can also hit us up on social media. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Thanks very much. We'll see you next week.